Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer in Tel Aviv. Israel is celebrating the daring operation that freed four hostages held by Hamas. It continues to wrestle with the conditions for a deal on the table to release more hostages as the war rages on, taking a terrible toll on both sides. And it is also facing a looming political crisis as Benny Gantz's National Unity Party, which joined the Netanyahu coalition in the name of unity, has now withdrawn from the government, rejoined the opposition, and there has also been rebellion in Netanyahu's Likud party over the controversial issue of exempting ultra-Orthodox Israeli men from serving in the army. So as we deal with this difficult and often dystopian reality in Israel, we see our conflicts reflected abroad. Over the past month, the focus of that conflict has been on American campuses, as an incredibly challenging academic year winds down, in which academia itself has been a battlefield. This was reflected in graduation ceremonies marked by protests, walkouts, and controversial speeches at graduation ceremonies, when the ceremonies took place at all. To take a deeper look at what this year on campus has been like, Haaretz sent reporter Linda Diane to California, and she came back with a series of articles about the state of academia. We'll talk to Linda on this podcast about what she saw and heard. Later on, we'll hear from Professor Dov Waxman, a professor of Israel Studies and the director of the Nazarian Center for Israel Studies at UCLA. We'll talk to him about what it's been like on the front lines at his university, as well as on the campus lawns where the protests are taking place. First up, my conversation with Linda Diane. Hi, Linda. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much.
So we at Haaretz decided to parachute you into California for the final weeks of the academic year. So what campuses did you visit?
I visited UCLA, UC Santa Cruz, and Stanford.
So let's start with UCLA. You spent Yom Ha'atzmaut, Israel Independence Day, kind of going back and forth between the pro-Israel crowd and the pro-Palestinian Gaza support encampment. And you were also there on Nakba Day. So can you tell us what those 2 days are like? And you wrote particularly of the dichotomies of your Nakba Day experience.
Of course. I went to the Hillel House for Yom Ha'atzmaut. That was my first stop. And it was interesting to see because you could tell that it was a lot more low-key than it had been in the past. Students there had told me that in recent years they've had it like on the lawn and it was more celebratory. But this year, for the sake of keeping a lower profile and it seemed safety, it was indoors with many security guards, three or four, I would say. And it was a combination of, a fun Independence Day celebration, but it was also marked by the somberness of the hostages are still in Gaza, we're still at war. People had gigantic stickers on their backs with the faces of different hostages to say that I'm keeping this person in my memory. And that was nice and fun. And I spoke to some students, and I even remember there was one student who didn't want to speak to me because I'm from Haaretz, which is identified as a more like left-wing critical of Israel newspaper. But students were upset and frustrated with what's been happening, especially with the encampment that was very much like in the center of everything. So it was kind of unavoidable for them. Some of them reported anti-Semitic experiences or their friends having experienced direct anti-Semitism. And some just expressed discomfort and frustration. And then I walked from there down the lawn to the space that is next to the location where they had been holding the Israeli Independence Day celebration in years past. And even though the UCLA encampment had been taken down and had experienced violence and police and what have you, they had set up a People's University, it was called, of students sitting on the grass and doing teach-ins, and professors would come lecture and students would sit and they brought in free food for the students. And I sat down for a PFLP study group.
Ooh, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, yes, which is a designated terrorist organization in the United States. But they handed out essentially the manifesto, the founding documents, and we were to read it in groups and then discuss it. and they had questions for discussion. And it was a really fascinating experience for many, many reasons. I ended up in a small group of students, and I don't think most of them had connections to the Middle East, like familial ties. Mm-hmm. But they were speaking very, very passionately, using a lot of the terminology that you would kind of see on the internet and, you know, global capitalism and linking it all to systems of oppression. And one of them wasn't even sure what country Israel bordered in the north.
Okay.
But it was really interesting to see the way that they related to that conversation and the fact that the conversation was going on at all.
Right. So, I mean, here, when we're watching from Israel and abroad, there's this tendency to paint things with a broad brush, right? They're all river to the sea. Israel should be eliminated. And then there's the theory that they're being led by people with extreme views, but that the vast majority of the students are more sort of, why can't everybody just get along, peace, hold hands? And they're being sort of like dragged towards more extremist positions by the leadership, which they say, you know, is funded by Qatar or whoever. What was your sense kind of from the ground actually talking to people? Are more of them like really absorbing these messages about Israel from 1948 being a settler, colonialist, genocidal entity that has to be removed? Or are the people who are saying that this is just sort of a small extremist group pulling the rest of them along and the majority are not so extreme?
It's hard to say. There seemed to be like an implicit understanding at all of these protests and all of these encampments that Zionism as a concept, meaning whatever someone defines it as, I didn't get a clear meaning from anybody, is a just an evil ideology, that Israel's founding is an original sin, that even before 1948, Zionism has been leading to ruin for the Arabs, and that is just part of a global white supremacist system of oppression of people of color. I can't say that every person there is, you know, at their core just wants everybody to live happily in peace. And I can't say that all of the leadership at their core wants all the, you know, all the Jews driven out of Israel. It depends on the day and the campus. And I've gone to magnificently different events on the same campus at the same encampment with wildly different messaging. And the same students were there and the same students were equally supportive of the two different types of programming.
Do you feel like Israel, Palestine, Gaza is being used as the tip of a spear of sort of wider discontent? Or do you feel like this is the event, like this is what they're focused on, this is what they care about?
Every single event that I went to connected it to wider global issues. Whether it was an American-led axis of global oppression, or it was Palestine, Sudan, Congo, Philippines, they are all linked. It was never just Gaza by itself. A lot of the students, when they would speak, and a lot of the protest leaders, when they would speak, would tie back their own family histories in like in Asian countries, in Latin America, and they would note the way that these causes are truly intertwined. So I think for very few students, it's just about Gaza, or it's just about Israel, or it's just about Palestine. For a lot of them, it's about America. And for a lot of these campuses, it should also be known, there are major STEM programs. These are people who are in science and technology and mathematics programs. And the students from the STEM programs are upset about their work being used to create either weapons or systems that can be used for military purposes.
So UCLA, you wrote, has a unique dimension in that there are many Persian Jews in the Los Angeles area, so therefore at UCLA, and you're of Syrian descent yourself. You say that they had kind of a different perspective on what was going on in their campuses, you know, coming from their family backgrounds. Can you talk about that, and also in the context of how Jewish students are feeling on campus in general?
Of course. For the Persian students in particular, there was the interesting dimension of they had gone through, or rather their families had gone through mass upheaval, usually within their parents' or grandparents' lifetime, that is still like very much a part of the family memory. And that upheaval, that being the 1979 Islamic Revolution, started in universities.
Right.
So they had grown up with their parents and grandparents telling them about these experiences, and they were like, ugh, okay, like, thanks, Mom. Like, that is so irrelevant to my life. That would never happen here. And suddenly a lot of them are starting to feel like history is repeating itself and are being told by the people around them that it's no big deal when they've seen from their own families what the effects of such movements can be. So that's a dimension that a lot of people haven't considered. And there's also the way that these student protest leaders talk about the conflict as if it were a European colonial project, which is so far removed from the experiences of these Middle Eastern and Persian students on campus who understand from their own histories that it is not even remotely that black and white.
And from you, I mean, did you blow their minds when you told them I'm a Syrian descended Jew who lives in Israel now?
Most of the time, when they knew that I was Israeli or when they knew that I was Jewish, they didn't have questions for me. I was kind of iced out. And that's something that we can talk about later as well. But it was also fascinating to see the way that people treated me when I told them that I was Syrian. Because being Arab at these events holds a certain amount of prestige. So people would say, like, oh, like, you're so involved in this. Are you Palestinian? I'd say, you know, no, my family's from Syria. And they'd be like, oh, okay. And suddenly I'd have, like, more questions and things that I could relate with to other Middle Eastern students there. And they'd be asking me things and I'd be speaking to them. And that's not something that I was ready to say, like, hey, guess what? I'm also an Israeli Jew, because that would have been the end of my trek around that location.
So you talked about being iced out. So in contrast, when you identified yourself an Israeli Jew, what was the reaction?
So I had a particularly interesting experience at University of California, Santa Cruz, where I went in as Haaretz. I spoke to some of the labor leaders there who were so happy to speak to me and so warm and so welcoming and also Jewish. And then I went into the encampment and I was wearing my press pass. My press pass is Hebrew on it. It's an Israeli press pass. And I went in and I asked if I could speak to students. And at these encampments, they do not speak to press unless they are press liaisons. So people were trying to find me press liaisons. And I spoke to a few people here and there. And I said, like, I am from Haaretz. I am from, like, an Israeli newspaper. I want you to be comfortable with that before speaking to me. And I spoke to someone, and she later came to me and was like, please don't use my name. And then later came back to me and said, like, please don't use anything I told you. And I was like, okay. But little by little, I was walking around the encampment and just talking to students, just chit-chatting about the music that they were playing. And I remember speaking to a group of students, and then we're having a great laugh. One of them turns to the other, starts, like, whispering frantically. They all look at each other, start whispering together, and just stop speaking and just give me this stony-faced look. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, I have a very strong feeling about what they're gossiping about. But as I'm walking around, I noticed that conversations that were going on near me would suddenly stop, even of groups of people I've never seen when I arrived. And, you know, there's no amount of social exclusion that could really get to me. I've been to middle school. Like, but there was a group of students who were talking to a local older man holding a Palestinian flag. And I was standing near them, just like catching my breath and taking notes. And all of a sudden they went quiet. And then I heard the older man say very loudly, but Gideon Levy's there. It's not such a bad place, huh? And I was like, oh, they're talking about me.
And Haaretz.
Exactly. And I ended up having a very interesting conversation with that older man about my newspaper, mm-hmm. about the protest movement, about Israeli public opinion about different things. All the while, students are standing there and just watching and will not respond to anything. And a student comes up to him and says, sir, we really advise you not to speak to this person.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm just like, this person. Like, for reference for listeners, I'm 4'11". Like, I'm very small and not very intimidating. But it was just a fascinating. I hadn't experienced anything like that as a journalist.
So just to wrap up, can you tell us what the contrast was between what you might have expected to find on campus when you were watching what was going on there from Israel, and when you encountered it in real life? Did it fit that picture of reality? Because we talk a lot in Israel about people from abroad looking at what's happening here and not seeing the nuance and not, you know, really understanding what's happening. Are Israelis doing that the other way around when it comes to the way that they're viewing the campus protests in America from here?
So I do think that Israelis aren't getting a complete picture of what's going on. I also think that it is much more difficult to get a complete picture than most people would assume. I was telling you about like the dichotomous experiences at certain campuses. And for one, I went to the Stanford encampment and I listened to students give a talk on guarding Palestinian families in West Bank towns that are hard hit by settler violence. It's nothing you wouldn't read in, you know, an Israeli paper. And it was very, I don't want to say like neutral and unbiased, but it was just their experiences doing this and factual information about it. And I had wished that more like pro-Israel students or any pro-Israel students had come. And I left thinking like there's really no way to take issue with any of what happened here. I wish that people knew about that. And then 2 days later, at the same Stanford encampment, they brought in an imam who was saying that Jews have a right of return to Poland and Russia. And just like really remarkably ahistorical and anti-Semitic statements. And it's like, okay, this is the same place, two different days, same students at both of them. You know, I guess it's everything everyone thought it was. It's everything that the peace camp in America thinks it is. And it's everything that the terrified Israelis think it is simultaneously.
So what would you say to a, I don't know, very identified Jew Israeli about being a student on the campuses these days? Do you really think that these campuses that you visited are a place where it's impossible for an identifiably Jewish Israeli, I'm not going to use the Z word, Zionist, person to go pursue their education and feel comfortable? Does this feel like a blip, or, you know, you couldn't really judge from the snapshot that you saw?
It's hard to say. And at some of these campuses, when I would speak to students and I would speak to professors, they would say, like, this is all completely avoidable. You don't have to walk past the encampment at some of these places. You don't have to engage with the students in these places. But I could also understand how Jewish students would feel knowing that they have certain kinds of programming going on their campus and that their classmates are going to it. It would definitely challenge a student who wants to be, say, like an outspoken Zionist activist on campus. And, you know, if they want to be one, you know, they have to consider, do they want to go to a school that doesn't have that kind of politically charged environment, or do they want to be in a place where they're going to be challenged? Even when I was identifying as an Israeli journalist, I did not necessarily feel physically unsafe. Mm-hmm. It might be different if I were a student and I knew the people around me who were chanting Intifada. But I understand where this discomfort comes from. I saw and heard some unpleasant things. But I don't think it's going anywhere necessarily. I think that we've shifted the way that we talk about Israel-Palestine on campuses. And I don't think it's necessarily possible to go back to the status quo of before this war.
Linda, I recommend that everybody go back and read the wonderful articles that you filed from your journey to California. And thanks so much for coming on the podcast and talking about them.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, I talk to Professor Dov Waxman from UCLA. Professor Dov Waxman is a professor of Israel Studies and the director of the Nazarian Center for Israel Studies at UCLA. He was a guest on this podcast on October 28th in the beginning of the academic year and just weeks after the October 7th attacks. That's when the unrest on U.S. campuses related to the Israel-Hamas conflict really began. Dov, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
So earlier we were talking to Haaretz journalist Linda Diane, who wrote a series of articles on how the Gaza protests are rocking campuses in the U.S. just as the year was finishing, winding up, the graduations, the ceremonies, and this was based on her visits to several California universities. So one of her pieces, which you were a big part of, was headlined, "As Gaza War Lingers, Israel Studies Professors on U.S. Campuses Throw Out the Syllabus." The story discussed the challenges of teaching Israel studies this year. There were quotes with words like punishing, describing what it was like inside and outside the classrooms. So tell us, do you feel like you and your colleagues indeed threw out your syllabus this year?
I think many people in Israel studies rethought their approach, particularly because, you know, many of the issues that we teach in our courses were front and center in our campuses. And so there was a need to really think about how we could kind of meet the moment and also to present the material in a way that is nuanced, that recognizes complexity, and that avoids some of the kind of simplistic slogans and approaches that we've heard all too often in the media and on our college campuses over the past year.
And did the students in the classrooms embrace that approach, or were you sort of caught up in classroom discussions in the lack of nuance and the polarized narratives? Or do you feel like, you know, it was possible in this atmosphere to teach nuance and detail and openness to narratives that perhaps the students in the classrooms didn't necessarily agree with?
Yeah, I think one of the striking things that, you know, when it comes to teaching about Israel and about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the fact that the students who take these courses are for the most part open-minded, willing to challenge their pre-existing views and opinions, willing to consider different narratives. And there is a general kind of spirit, I think, in the classes that I've taught, and I think that's true for many of my colleagues as well, who find that the students who are wanting to take these classes recognize the things they don't know. They choose to take the classes because they want to learn more. And so the quality of the conversations and discussions in the classes are rich and nuanced. And it's often very striking how different the discourse is in the classroom from outside the classroom.
So we've seen pictures of what happened outside the classroom. What was it like being out there on the lawns, on the, I don't like to use the metaphor, but battlefield? Did you feel like this was something that you needed to participate, engage in, address, or did you feel like your role was to stay in the classroom and teach and not deal with what was happening outside?
No, I felt a responsibility to really be a witness to what was taking place, precisely because I was aware of the, you know, contrasting narratives that have been swirling around events on my campus and on other college campuses. And so I felt like it was necessary to be there to observe and to try to be a witness and to provide an account if that was necessary. I didn't imagine that I'd be kind of brought into these protests in any way, and or that I'd be required at all to keep protesters apart or anything like that. But I did think it was important, and I think many faculty members felt it was important to be there to observe, to be play a witness, and to support our students. And so, being there on the campus, particularly in the hours before the big protest encampment was dismantled by the police, was, for me at least, a very surreal experience. I mean, to see hundreds of heavily armed riot police lining up on what is normally, you know, the quad in the center of our campus where students, you know, hang out and converse, to see that filled with riot police, to see, you know, much of what seemed like the world's media kind of converging on our campus, and then the students behind these now, you know, basically barricades preparing for the advance of the police. It was a very, very surreal experience. And all of a sudden, you know, the whole eyes of the world were on UCLA. And it was disturbing because I worried mostly for the safety of the students and faculty inside the encampment. But I also worried about what all the attention and all the external attention, how that would impact relations on the campus and the climate on the campus.
Just briefly, can you, for those who aren't familiar, tell us the narrative of how it played out? The confrontation between different camps or different sides of the demonstration, and then how that led to subsequently the intervention of the police?
To start with, I mean, it's always challenging where you begin the story, but let's begin it with the establishment of the protest encampment at UCLA, which I think sprung up shortly after the protest encampment at Columbia. The one at UCLA was established the end of April, 25th of April. Initially, the administration at UCLA took a fairly hands-off approach and wasn't planning to dismantle it or call in the police. The encampment, as happened elsewhere, generated a lot of controversy and significant concerns by some students and faculty. There was a large counter demonstration that took place a few days after the encampment was established. This was a counter demonstration that was organized by the Israeli American Council and the local Jewish Federation. That brought a lot of pro-Israel supporters onto campus. That heightened tensions on the campus, and I was there on that day and seeing kind of scuffles between pro-Palestinian protesters and pro-Israel counter-protesters. So tensions were already rising then, and they continued to rise in subsequent nights as some people started to try to get into the encampment or even attack the encampment. That escalated a couple of nights later, when a kind of mob essentially laid siege for hours to the encampment, trying to violently dismantle it and attack it. That was witnessed by many people. The campus security and the local police did not intervene for hours while that attack was taking place. The next day after that very violent attack, the administration decided that they needed to dismantle and clear the encampment. And so the very next night, a large number of police came onto campus and dismantled the encampment, and around 200 students and faculty were arrested. Some students were injured, even hospitalized as a result of the police going in to dismantle the encampment. And so that brought to the end to the encampment, but then the controversies and the conflicts continued. There was a vote of to censor the chancellor, a vote of no confidence, which didn't in the end pass. We had a strike last week of graduate students and teaching assistants who carried out a strike to protest against the actions of the administration. And there have been other attempts in the last couple of weeks to occupy more campus buildings. And we still have commencement coming up, and many people expect there's going to be another protest taking place at our commencement. So the situation still is tense, and there's still a real possibility for continued protest.
Wow. As you wrote prolifically in Haaretz, quote, I'll quote you to yourself, "I wasn't trained for this. I'm a professor. I'm supposed to be teaching students and doing research, not doing crowd control." How do you feel now about, you know, your ivory tower?
Well, I think one of the things we've realized is that the idea that, you know, professors live in an ivory tower is really, you know, a kind of antiquated idea. I mean, not just at UCLA, but around the country, we have been, you know, under a microscope for the past 8 months, really. There's been a huge amount of media attention and political attention, and attention from the organized Jewish community on everything that's happening on campus. So we've really been under a lot of scrutiny. Some of it, I think, is understandable. And so, you know, it's if we were ever in an ivory tower disconnected from the affairs of the world, that has certainly not felt the case over the last 8 months. But even with all of that said, I never thought I would be, you know, having to put myself between protesters and counter-protesters. The fact that I did that, and I wasn't the only one, I had other colleagues doing the same, really, to me, just demonstrated a failure of the campus security to do their job, which was to ensure that these demonstrations that had been authorized, at least the pro-Israel demonstration had been authorized by the university, that didn't lead to tensions and violence and scuffles. And I think the fact that, you know, professors had to put themselves between protesters, really raises the question of why campus security wasn't doing that.
I know you were very much an advocate of free speech, of the right of the pro-Palestinian side, the encampment, to express criticism of Israel's policies, of the Gaza war. Are you critical or supportive of the decision of the quote-unquote pro-Israel side, you know, backed by the Israel-American Council and the federations, to counter those protests? Do you feel like equally that was their right to speak out and have free speech? Do you feel like it, you know, was unfortunate that it raised tensions that way? Like, I mean, I look at you personally, you're a member of the Jewish community and you're a representative of the university and an advocate of academic discourse and free speech. You must have really felt caught in the middle there. You know, how do you look at each side and at how it behaved? And do you have criticism of how things were handled on either side or both?
So I do believe in the importance of free speech for all students, whether they're pro-Palestine or pro-Israel. And I believe all students and faculty, for that matter, have a right to freedom of speech. And that includes to engage in peaceful political protest. So on the one hand, I supported the right of the students who identify as pro-Palestine to protest, but I also support the right of pro-Israel people to protest and or to engage in a rally as well. So my issue with the large counter demonstration that took place wasn't that they didn't have a right to be there, but rather whether it was helpful, whether it was actually going to contribute to reduction of tensions, which is what I think everybody in the Jewish community at UCLA, students, staff and faculty, wanted, was to de-escalate a very tense situation and not escalate it. And so my criticism was more that that external advocacy groups who have their own interests and their own agendas were coming onto campus to engage in this counter demonstration. And they were doing so not at the behest, not because the Jewish community at UCLA was seeking them, was asking them to do this, but just because they decided to do this, they decided for their own reasons to do that. And in actual fact, I think that counter demonstration, and even more so the mob violence that followed a couple of nights later, that really actually made the situation much worse on campus, and actually undermined the position of many Jewish students, staff and faculty, or people within the pro-Israel community who objected to the solidarity encampment. Because essentially, after the encampment and the students faced this horrific violence, both first of all from the mob and then the violence from the police, there was an outpouring, understandably, of sympathy for those students who had been beaten and arrested. Overwhelmingly, you know, across the campus, there was a lot of sympathy and support for them. And that made it actually impossible to point out any of the issues with the encampment. It made it quite difficult to note, for example, that the demands that these students were making were, you know, problematic, to say the least. And so actually it had the opposite effect. It actually, by having that counter demonstration, it ultimately set in motion a kind of chain of events which led to more support, not less, for that pro-Palestine encampment, and made those who were critical of it more, even more marginalized and isolated on the campus.
Yeah, speaking of the demands, Linda wrote that the Nazarian Center has been doing what it can to support students in distress and promote dialogue between students from opposing camps, that you guys were doing this even though one of the encampment's demands was to cut ties with the Israel Studies Center. So you yourselves were a target.
That's right. And you know, I thought that was really quite surprising to me, because while I wasn't surprised by the demand to divest from businesses and companies that are involved with Israel or with Israeli companies, that has long been one of the central demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. I was surprised that the protesters were demanding that kind of anything that even was even linked with Israel, Israel Studies, was somehow suspicious, that this actually went beyond BDS. This wasn't just calling for a boycott, bad though that would be, of Israeli academic institutions. It was also calling for a boycott of, you know, an academic center that is not connected to Israel, that just studies Israel. And I think that to me raises a broader kind of concern I have, which is that there is, among some on the campus, a view that anything that is perceived as connected to Israel should be removed from the campus. That any association. So it goes beyond just an attempt to, you know, pressure Israel or isolate Israel, but actually to kind of ostracize and exclude anything or anyone connected to Israel. And of course, that includes many people on the campus, myself included.
So it's kind of hard to be whatever, view yourself as an interlocutor trying to help be between the two sides when the fact that one of the sides is pushing for your elimination is kind of forcing you onto one of the sides of the debate.
Yeah, I mean, I try, you know, to not make this about the Nazarian Center. There were bigger issues at stake than the Nazarian Center. And at the end of the day, I didn't think there was any real risk that the Nazarian Center would be abolished by the administration. So I wasn't worried in terms of what this demand would actually lead to. But it certainly, you know, it was certainly disappointing that students would see the center in this light and would have basically accused the center of complicity with, you know, what they perceive as genocide. And, you know, I think that just conveyed a complete misunderstanding of what the center is about and the work that we do. The same misunderstanding, I should note, exists among some in the pro-Israel community. So in the pro-Palestine community, there's that perception that Israel studies is, you know, a kind of propaganda exercise, that it's in league with, you know, the pro-Israel community in pushing pro-Israel narratives, and it's just a kind of another quote, you know, what they denounce as kind of another Zionist organization on campus. In the pro-Israel community, there's also this view that actually that's what the Israel Studies Center should be. They should be these, you know, Zionist entities on campus promoting pro-Israel perspectives and narratives. Neither side, or at least though, you know, significant numbers on both sides, fail to see and recognize that the purpose of Israel Studies is not to support the positions of Israeli governments, but rather is just a place for whoever, whatever their politics, to study Israel just as you would study any other country with the same, you know, tools and analyses and theories and approaches. It's not a political exercise. It's not engaged in it, or it shouldn't be engaged in advocacy. We're not in one side or another. And I felt over the past year, particularly, this perception on both sides and the attacks coming from both sides, who are really challenging the independence and the impartiality of not only my center, but, you know, Israel Studies as a whole.
I guess you can subscribe to the philosophy, if you choose to spin it in a positive light, that if both sides hate you, you must be doing something right.
Yeah, that's generally how I like to approach things. It feels though that there's always been that perception on both sides. There's always been a challenge to kind of explain the purpose of Israel Studies and to people who see it in this kind of very politicized way. But that's felt almost impossible to do over the last 8 months. There's much less willingness in general for just having kind of serious scholarly discussions, nuanced conversations. More and more people are demanding you basically pick a side.
You know, rewinding back to October when we spoke, you talked a lot about making the distinction between Jewish students on campus feeling unsafe by protests. I'm quoting you to yourself again. That might be entirely peaceful, but the rhetoric at that protest upsets and disturbs them and makes them uncomfortable, and feeling physically threatened and unsafe. And you said while you understood the former, you questioned whether the latter was a reality. That was in October. What you saw play out over campus, are you still believe basically that Jewish students are made to feel uncomfortable or upset or disturbed, but they're not actually threatened? Or does what played out over the course of the year make you feel that they have more legitimacy in feeling actually physically threatened and unsafe?
Well, I think it varies from campus to campus and at different times. But I've certainly, over the past 8 months, I've certainly recognized that there's cause that Jewish students who have felt threatened, who have felt unsafe, you know, there are reasons for that. And some of those reasons don't just exist in their heads. They're as a result of the actions and rhetoric of protesters. It's understandable, for example, why some Jewish students might feel threatened by a large gathering of people with their faces covered, in most cases with keffiyehs, you know, chanting slogans like globalize the intifada. That is something that I recognize is not unreasonable for many Jewish students to feel threatened by that. And there's not just a question of rhetoric. It's not just about speech. There's also been actions. Students have been threatened. There's even been cases of students being assaulted or intimidated. So I don't want to just say it's just about the discomfort. I think we have to distinguish the issue of discomfort, I think, relates much more to the question of pro-Palestine speech, and particularly some of the chants that have been voiced at these some of the pro-Palestine rallies. But the issue is not just discomfort, but nor is it just safety. I think too often there's been this invocation of the safety of Jewish students, and that kind of fails to distinguish between the challenges that they face. Sometimes there are real threats of safety, and there are real concerns, and we've seen that happen on some campuses. Other times, it is more about, you know, the experience of feeling discomfort or upset. But I think another issue which has come up, and which in some ways was magnified by these protest encampments, is the issue of exclusion, which is to say, it's not just about speech that some Jewish students are opposing and that they might find uncomfortable or threatening, but they also are facing exclusion, exclusion from social clubs, exclusion from social activities, exclusion from participating in the life of the university because of their real or perceived support for Israel or support for Zionism. And I think that's a somewhat different issue on this kind of ostracization of pro-Israel students that, again, predated October the 7th, but it was in some ways symbolized by these protest encampments, because what the protest encampments, at least at UCLA and in other places, did was exclude those who identified with Zionists. Essentially, if they were perceived to be, you know, quote unquote, Zionists or Zionist agitators, they weren't allowed into these encampments. And that meant, you know, Jewish students who might have wanted to go by or enter these encampments were denied entry. And that kind of magnified, I think, in many people's minds, this long-standing issue of exclusion. So I think there are real reasons for Jewish students to be concerned, but I think we have to be careful to distinguish between threats to physical safety, which exists sometimes, but and then the kind of emotional discomfort, as well as the problem of exclusion. And I also think we have to recognize that Jewish students are diverse, and that in actually some of the actual physical safety of some Jewish students was threatened in some cases by those outside of the encampment. It was Jewish students inside the encampment. At UCLA, there were Jewish students in the encampment, and they were attacked by that mob. And they also faced the police going in. So it's not just that Jewish students were on one side of this issue, and it was only pro-Israel Jewish students who faced physical threat. Actually, it was students on both sides of this issue. I would just also add that I think the other issue we have to acknowledge is the very real threats to their physical safety and also to their emotional well-being that non-Jewish students have faced, particularly Palestinian, Arab and Muslim students. One of the striking things over the last 8 months has been, and the surveys have shown this, that it's not just Jewish students. The majority of Jewish students in a recent survey said they had felt their personal safety was threatened over the last 8 months. But so too did a majority of Muslim students. So when we talk about the issue of safety for students, we have to recognize it's not just about Jewish students who feeling unsafe. It is also Muslim students, Palestinian and Arab students. And all too often, we in our discourse over the last number of months, we've only focused on one group of students and ignoring the safety and the well-being of others.
Professor Dov Waxman, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me back. It's been great to talk with you.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Thanks to my guests, Linda Diane and Dov Waxman, and to my producer, Avri Rosenzvi, and editor, Nara Malkin. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, shalom from Tel Aviv.